I'm not into flipping figures. That's
yeah. Only one of the four of us is selling toys around here.
Yeah.
Oh man, I just fell into it. Like I had so many of those extra Build-A-Figure pieces, and I was just like, "What am I gonna do with these?" And then I look up online, and I'm like, "These people."
Oh, they sell yeah like crazy. That's why I'm keeping mine in the boxes. Yeah, I brought some to a show,
and it was like $5 each.
Hmm. One of these days, I swear to God, I'm gonna become a seller.
Oh yeah,
I got a box of extra.
It's just you need time because it takes time to sell it all.
Yeah. That's just
or what I do now too is theoretically, you know, everything got screwed up, but I was like, getting the figures, getting the piece, and then just selling the figures without the piece because I'm just like I'm going to a show. People like cheap figs, so I'm like, I don't have a problem like buying a figure for like. Whatever the price is, knocking off, like, I don't know, $10 or something. And then, like, just selling the fig, and I got my piece. Like, I don't...
Mm-hmm.
But, Phil, it's not just the time selling. Like, Kevin has to do time setting up, so he has to get there early. He has to go threaten the other dealers. Maybe they had a few accidents with their merchandise. You know, set everything up so when he shows up to sell, they understand how it's going to work.
Yeah.
It's taken over.
But it's funny, too. Like, you get the inside scoop, and, like, you, like, catch up with everyone, like, before the show. So it's, like, you have that extra, like, behind the scenes. Where I think some people have asked, like podcasters or whatever, oh, is it as fun for regular people as it is for you? Like, I would have a different experience if I wasn't also selling.
Well, some
of the...
It would
still be a good time, but...
Some of the dirt shows out here, it's an extra couple bucks to be one of the early ones in, so you can pick over the merch. I mean, obviously the dealers have already swapped whatever merch they're going to swap, but you get it before us regular peasants wander in and everything's been grubbed over pretty well.
Yeah.
This show is not for the easily offended, so if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
We've had worse titles.
Have we? I would say, have we had better titles? I feel all our titles are right in that sweet zone of, doesn't tell you anything. All right, well...
What was that one, Andrew? You had someone like old men tilting at the windmills or something, something, something.
Yeah, clearly memorable. All right, guys, we have anything to get off our chests? Before I officially start this, I mean, obviously I'm recording, but, you know, I won't put it in the episode.
Whoa. It's funny. He's trying to get unprompted intros.
Welcome back.
Supposedly, we're going.
Welcome back, Steve. Nothing's changed.
We have guest Super Steve with us today.
Welcome back, Indie Comic Book Noise listeners. As you heard, WWX announcing... Our hot news of the day is returning champion Super Steve from the bunker is back. Say hi, Super Steve.
What's up, guys?
Wait, he recorded that?
I made it back. I said I'd be back.
Additionally, even though he had a one-week hiatus, he's back. The Ottawa Otter.
Hello.
Phil, how's things in the Capitol?
COVID crazy.
And lastly, dialing in from the icebox with two X's, the image man himself, WWX Kev. Say hi, Kev.
Wow, I'm the image man. I mean, we did talk a lot of image last time.
I'm the image man. What are you talking about?
Yes, we have a full host, a full roster, all four hosts. Well, yeah, we're promoting Steve back to host.
We're talking at once.
He's back in.
Four people talking at once for your entertainment.
the check cashed. You got the contract down. He signed it, stamped it, mailed it back.
Indie Comic Book Noise is part of the Deliberate Noise Network. The Deliberate Noise Network, you say, what's that? It's a collection of podcasts and lifestyle brands featuring all the things you want to know about. There are plenty of other comic book focused podcasts, including one, I believe, called Marvel Noise, Super Steve. What can you tell us about Marvel Noise?
Well, twice a month, we talk about anything Marvel-related. I host, and you and Kevin are my partners in crime.
Well, that makes it sound like we're all colluding.
It is from that show that this show was birthed, or at least our tenure here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's now become your tenure. I used to drive, and now I'm just along for the ride.
And if you're curious about past episodes to investigate the mystery Super Steve laid before you, you can go to our website. What's that? It's at www.indiecomicbooknoise.com. That's Indie. I mean, I'm sure whatever podcast catcher also retains some past episodes, but as you can tell, the show has been around for a long time. In fact, we've been hosts for quite a while of that, although you can go back to the very old days before we were hosts. And also, I put in show notes that sometimes have links to Kickstarters or this, that, or the third thing. Or Kevin puts in rude, insulting comments in the show notes. All that sort of stuff.
Yeah, sometimes.
It's like a bonus round. I only put the good stuff. It's Kevin that puts the bad stuff. You can also contact the show via social media. We have a Twitter handle. Well, I mean, we, as in the podcast, but it's separate from the four of us. It's kind of complicated. It's Indie Comic Book N. The oys is left to your imagination. We have a Facebook fan page that I have never seen nor check into, but Kevin religiously maintains it. Kevin, how are we going with our TikTok page? You said you were going to get the TikTok going. How's that going?
It's like this is a board meeting and everyone's having to report on their areas.
So
about as well as your Discord channel, Andrew.
Okay. So when Kevin gets the TikTok up, remember to follow that and our Instagram. I don't know. Phil, do you want to set up the Instagram? I feel you should have some responsibility in this as well.
Sure. Just explain to me what an Instagram is.
It's something that's instant, and it's a gram. It's not a money gram. It's not a photogram.
Oh, wait, I can't give that to Canadians. They think a gram is a unit of measurement. Damn it.
Yeah.
All right. Indie Comic Book Noise, what is it? Well, as you heard from the warning at the beginning of the show, we do sometimes venture, because Indie Comic Book Noise is all-encompassing, it can cover adult themes, adult concepts. Some would call it bad language that gets peppered in. But as I always say, to disclaim our disclaimer, we're like a couple of nice guys. Like, we never say anything that would harm even the sensibilities of the most genteel great-grandperson.
Booger. I mean, the most controversial thing we might say is that Black Hammer might be slightly overrated. When you don't read superhero comics regularly, you really don't know what's out there.
And Indie Comic Noise itself is just an open round table for a discussion of anything independently comic book related noise. So that just means it's not exclusively big two, although we have a rather holistic view of the comic book industry. So it tends to stretch the boundaries. Additionally, I have long waxed poetic about my love of media tie-ins from movies to video games to novelty candles. I think last time I asked Kev what his favorite novelty clothing tie-in was. So, Phil, do you have any kind of sheets or towels or waste cans featuring indie comic book characters?
Oh, no, but my comic room is all like a Hellraiser puzzle box pattern. So the rug is the puzzle box, the light fixtures.
Wow.
Like everything is the pillows. Everything is all puzzle box. So I do that.
Sounds like a dangerous place to drop psychedelics. I have a lot of props and psychedelics.
Hellraiser and stuff. So
talk about being trapped in a box.
Can I go first? Because I got a book that covers all like everything you're saying already. It goes back to an old episode that you can only find on indiecomicbooknoise.com. It is a media tie-in, but only in a tertiary way. And, you know. I've been chomping at the bit because I haven't been on in a few episodes.
That's why it's love you, Super Steve, your enthusiasm. When it's just Kevin and I, it's like pulling teeth to get
anything. And it's not personal. The book that I have, well, it's kind of like two hardbacks because a Burly Man comics are back with a couple of releases. Nice.
They did the Doc Frankenstein in that?
Exactly. Yeah, and that's nice. That's the first book. I first talked about the miniseries back on Indie Comic Book Noise 373 back in November 2015. And it's Doc Frankenstein, the Postmodern Prometheus.
I love that one.
The by the Wachowskis and Steve Skroke and Jeff Darrow, though he was just involved conceptually. This was born, pun intended, in the back offices of the making of the Matrix trilogy. They came up with the story and went with it. There were six issues that ran from 2004 to 2006. And this beautiful oversized hardcover from Burly Man has just been released. And it completes those issues and 64 new pages that complete the story. Because it wasn't finished. And, I mean, that's the whole... There's a really interesting, lengthy foreword by one of the Wachowskis, too, saying that, like, you know, so many things have changed since we started this book and are finishing this book. And it's like, we started this book as brothers and now we're sisters. And the whole tie-in of the coming out and that tying into their love of the Frankenstein mythology and being a hunted, you know, individual that doesn't feel like they deserve to be alive in some way and are justifying that to those who don't understand that kind of thing. And it's fun. It's the Frankenstein's monster as like a Doc Savage like science hero who has gone through time. Like they show him in the Wild West, they show him in World War One, and then like in modern times where he's built this giant fortress city to live in peace in, and there's a whole populace there and stuff. But he's always attacked by this like fundamentalist Christian church militia who just can't, you know, let the abomination, you know, stand. This thing can't live, right? And this story with the fit, like where it ended up going with the 64 new pages was not where I expected to go. It was really entertaining, though. It goes all the way back to Christ, ancient lies like in the Catholic Church and stuff, and it's just a really fun ride. It's like the fundamentalist followers of the Messiah versus the Messiah of science. And it's like the irrational versus the rational. And it's drawn really nicely.
Yeah, I remember loving the artwork.
And then the other hardcover is by Burly Man that came out is the Matrix Comics 20th Anniversary Edition.
I thought you were going to say Shaolin Cowboy.
These, oh, no, those are good too, though. Those Dark Horses reprinted.
Oh, they've reprinted
all that whole library of those. But the Matrix comics weren't ever meant to be published. They were a bunch of commissioned 1- and 2-page comics for the Matrix.com as like cross promoting the movie and, you know, the mythology around the movie and stuff. But after 4 years of doing that, they had enough to collect them in a couple of trade paperbacks, which they did, but that didn't include all of them, and this does. So there's some good stuff, there's some not so good stuff, there's some stuff that's really only tangentially related, and there's stuff that's more directly related. There's familiar names like Darrow and Sienkiewicz and stuff, and a bunch of guys I've never heard of too, and it's a lot of fun to page through and just get a quick blast of something. Nice thing to have as a collection, and but of the two books, certainly the Frankenstein Prometheus book is I really recommend, because
I have to get that one now that it finishes it. Yeah,
it was good, really good, and it looks great big too because it's that Skroke art.
I'm afraid with Frankenstein I always think of Bernie Wrightson. Super Steve, I know you're sure. The same,
of course.
Yeah, that's good too.
This is like Frankenstein with a gun. Like he's, you know, he's,
well, it's like he's Tom Strong.
Yeah, right. Who was a Doc Savage kind of, you know, referential type character. Yeah.
Well, we also Distinguished Competition Comics had Frankenstein Agent of Shade during their New 52 renaissance. And Marvel also had their Monster Squad idea. Like, I think people like those old-timey creatures, kind of with a new coat of paint on them. Literally, I guess, in this case.
I always go for the Golden Age classics.
All right, Kevin, regale us with this comic from your childhood.
Well, I'm supposed to have a comic from my childhood? Oh.
Yeah, you said you were going to bring a Golden Age comic.
Well, I'll have to disappoint you then, Andrew. The closest I could find to a Golden Age comic was this Turtles thing. I don't know if that's what you're looking for. I mean, this was supposed to go last.
Well, isn't everyone's Golden Age a different time? So for you, it was the Turtles, the sweet time of a young boy discovering comic books.
No, I think your Golden Age was supposed to be when you first started reading comics, because then it works with that theory of nostalgia and everything. And then I guess I became the outlier and I broke their theory. So that's always exciting. I mean, the 80s is the greatest comics time.
Yeah,
but I was not reading comics in the 80s.
I always think of the Golden Age as kind of being the time right before you started reading, because like you kind of, you know, have to learn about it as a history rather than as stuff that's happening. You know what I mean? And I don't know, maybe that's just me. The Golden Age always seems like before.
Older. I don't know. There's that weird thing where like everything that happened before, you just accept what happened. But once you're reading, then if new things happen, you don't, like, at some point you become, well, I guess not everyone, but, you know, you could become this, like, hardliner where you're, like, everything new is, like, oh, that stuff happened before I started reading. That's all cool. But the stuff after, like, oh, I can't accept these changes anymore. Which leads to, like, totally weird and, you know, because, like, characters are married or whatever, and you're like, no, that's the thing, being married. And then some old man from 30 years ago is just like, oh, I hate you kids for liking that book. And then like the next generation is coming along and I'm like, oh yeah, I like when he's a clone. And you're just like, that's not the real stuff.
I think somehow Kevin tricked us into talking about Batman again. But what I like is when I started, because I was a little kid and pretty stupid, like, I didn't put a lot of, like, a lot of it went over my head and I didn't understand. So it was kind of a weird, you're reading stuff out of order, or weird comics. I didn't know if this went with that and, like, who was with what or, you know, they do a good job of brand differentiation. But in the beginning, it's all like, you're just reading comics, you know, someone gives it to you and maybe it's out of the Sunday paper or maybe it's someone hands it to you or whatever. And you're like, cool.
If it's an Archie, if it's a Harvey, if it's a Charlton, if it's a Gold Key, if it's a Marvel, if it's a DC, you just get your hands on it and read it all, you know? If Classics Illustrated, shoot, if that's all there is, I'll try.
Well, I decided to pick the feature things that aren't comic books but are dangerously close to comic books. So,
oh, no.
I selected one from my childhood, a Gold Key. You kids may remember was a publisher of some renowned who specialize in all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
I have one of their Story Digest magazines.
Is it a Ditko?
No, Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan of the Apes. So this was a reprint of a reprint, but it's adapted exclusively for this magazine from the authentic writings of Edgar Rice Burroughs by Gaylord Dubois, illustrated by Dan Spiegel.
Oh, nice.
So it's like a real tiny little jobber from like 1970. So like one of those pocket books is really little and big print, you know, dumbed down. But there are illustrations in it, but they're monochrome illustrations. But I had to verify, this is old vintage, 1970. And because the color printing like shifts, it's one color. So it's mostly black and white with like green or red. I had to verify that it wasn't colored in by hand by me or someone else because the coloring doesn't match at all. Like, I'm not even talking close. Like, it goes over the line work and doesn't go up to, like, it's just, it looks like someone colored it in, and I'm sure that's an artifact of the printing, but could it be intentional? Is someone like, I want splashes of color that are mostly on his arm and over his arm and under top, because I'm like, this looks like someone started coloring it in with a crayon or marker and quit.
Wow.
I mean, once in a while it works, but most of the time I really had to pull other online copies to be like, because, you know, like old black and white comics, this is going to make some people gasp. Some of us may have colored in or drawn in them or whatever when you're a little kid. Like, you don't look at it as an artifact, especially this kind of big blocky line work. It looks almost like a coloring book, for criminy's sake. So I was like, wow, did I or some relative color this in half at, but the fact it's only one color each plate confirmed it. But yeah, it's so off scale. But yeah, you could see Tarzan fighting snakes and indigenous people helping them out. Dan Spiegel, no doubt, has gone on to bigger and brighter things, but I think a lot of the people used to really like that Tarzan. I remember as a kid, they kept making movies and cartoons and stuff. I think it's kind of faded off. I was never a big Tarzan guy, even though I have this thing.
I used to love that Tarzan TV show, the live action one.
Mm. Never saw. I saw, there was a cartoon when I was a kid that ran, I think, with Batman as like a package deal. But it just, I don't know, like it was boring to me. Like some dude in his underwear.
Those type of heroes like Zorro and Lone Ranger.
I like Zorro and Lone Ranger better because they have better costumes. Like this dude's running around in his underwear. Like that's not.
I think you need something more exciting for a dude that's running around in his underwear.
Yeah, like if sexy. You're,
like if you throw in some dinosaurs or if he's like Commandy or something, like you have more things to pull from, like more crazy stuff.
But there was more unknown back when.
That's true too.
He was writing, you know what I mean? It's all about having some unknown frontier and being in some environment where the environment is part of the story too, like as much a character as the characters, as whether it's underwater stuff or outer space or the Hyborian age or the deepest part of the jungle. My grandfather was really into ERB and had all the Tarzan books and really enjoyed that mythology and could rattle off this, that, and the other thing about it. And I dabbled into it as well and bought the Marvel and DC comic books back in the day when it was Kubert and, you know, John Buscema doing the art. So there was a lot to enjoy just about the figure work.
Did you ever go to Gorilla City?
But then I graduated to Conan from that. That was like, oh, no, this is way better. This is like, this is what I'm enjoying about these types of stories. I dug it a lot more. More characters, more different types of civilizations, the more varied environment and everything. So my grandfather and grandmother used to come up and visit. And when I was probably in about, seventh grade, maybe eighth grade, my grandfather, I came home from school and came up to my room, which was the finished attic of my parents' house. And my grandfather's laying on the floor. He had a bad back. So he was laying on this like pad on the floor with his head propped up with a stack of Savage Sword of Conans that he pulled out of a box from my shelf. And he's going through read them. He's like, this Conan is great.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. One of the plates, he has a knife here, but Conan had all them weapons. Like, it was more interesting than just a guy hanging out with a bunch of monkeys and gorillas and stuff. Like, that didn't, I mean, it should have. Yeah. Now I'm more into, like, that would be a fun way to go live with a bunch of elephants. They seem pretty cool. But as a kid, I'm like, oh, come on. And most of the adaptations I saw, they didn't give him weapons. And this only has one plate. Like, usually it's just him wrestling like a monkey, and that doesn't. Like, that's not, it's an impressive feat, but when you're a little kid, you're like, that's no big, that's not impressive. Like, now I know, like, oh my God, chimpanzees are like 10 times stronger than men or whatever. But as a kid, you're like, he's beating up a monkey. Like, I'm supposed to get worked up about this?
Look up Mike Grell, Tarzan, Neil Adams, Tarzan, and, you know, that kind of stuff. I think you'll appreciate it.
I'm going to stick with Mike Grell, Warlord. Now, there's a guy, he's got a sword and on guns and beating people up.
Mike Grell? But this is indie noise.
It was better than Tarzan. But anyway.
Star Slayer.
That was
Log of the Jolly Roger.
But it's not really a comic because it's big print with illustrated plates. I just thought it was funny that I was like, man, I hope this was intended to be printed this way.
It's a chopped up Sunday strip. You know,
it's just the single full page plates. I mean, it's a little book. And then text. It's not. I mean, they might have lifted. Yeah, you're right. They probably lifted these, but they took like full segmented panel. Yeah, it might be the size of a newspaper.
Key. Oh, you know what? Gold Key used to have the Tarzan license, though. I actually have a few issues of their Tarzan. I think Spiegel was the artist, so they just pulled it from their regular monthly color books.
Yeah, and the other thing is it's a fake out too, because like the cover always looks nice and it's full color and.
Yes,
he's throwing. He's throwing like a monkey and some jujitsu move, but like you read it, and that's not what's inside. Huh. So it was, but it's not really a comic. But
they were the Dynamite Entertainment, you know, of their day. They had the licenses, you know. They had the Star Trek ones with the same thing. The covers would be lush, and you open it up, and it's like, eh, not so much.
Speaking of Dynamite, there are. I've been collecting a couple Dynamites, surprisingly. The ones where Vampirella and Red Sonja are superheroes. They're on superhero teams. Yeah, they look, I haven't read them yet, but they look kind of good, and the art looks good, too.
Isn't it like versions of the, like, Kirby powers?
I haven't really flipped through them, so I'm not, like, I only flipped through them a bit, so yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I know there's a Sonja one where it's, like, every...
I tried that one. I didn't like that. It's like different versions of her.
Sonyaverse.
Yeah. It's like.
I don't like that.
Enter the Sonyaverse.
Yeah. It's yeah.
But the Sonya's
great. I wish they could do something that was entertaining with her. They could tell good stories for Pete's sake. Everything's a stunt, but some of the stunts are fun.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, at least if the art's good, you got that going for it, right?
On the cover.
You hate your Dynamite.
Oh wow. Well, right. I got something for us.
Lay it on us, WX Kev.
This is one, since I'm the image guy, I'm like, I gotta do an image book. Sure. This is one of those things where it's on the previous catalog. And then you're like, whoa, there's a lot of push behind this. And then some, maybe, I couldn't tell if there was a lot of real buzz or if it was fake buzz or whatever. But it was on the previous catalog cover, so I guess maybe there was some kind of buzz, some kind of press, some kind of something behind it.
Oh, Kevin, you can just buy books if you like them. You don't need to always be worried about if you can flip them for big money. You can just buy something and enjoy it for once.
Well, this could be the next Invincible number one. You never know.
Yes, I know. You're our investment guru. Do you have any hot tips for the listeners? Isn't there an Invincible
show right now, too, on Prime?
It's supposed to come out soon.
Yeah.
Ooh, that should be fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's animated, too. Anyhow.
It's funny that those two type of things, like, cross paths. It's just like, you don't have to be on that investment path. But sometimes along that investment path, I'm actually interested, too, in what the thing is. And I'm like, I'll buy a few issues. Like, I don't care. I mean, maybe in the past, I would have been more like, oh, I can only get so many titles a month. And now I'm like, I have a room for a couple extra things if, you know, something comes my way. I don't care.
Do you guys think it's time for an intervention with Kevin, or do you think we should let him go for a little while longer?
I think he's free to make all... I like it. He's making moves, cornering the market, arbitrage, crashing, investments going in.
As soon as things go south, though, we're going to have a good talking to.
He makes a move here, makes a move there, makes a couple million.
You short a couple of mil, I go on the street for you. I make a couple of moves, A mill here, a mill there. You got it. Okay.
Wow. So the book I'm talking about here is Radiant Black by Kyle Higgins, Marcelo Costa, with Becca Casey. So I was led to believe, it's an awesome cover too by Michael Cho. I mean, it's really eye-catching. You're like, ooh. You would almost say, Andrew, that this has a better cover than The Inside, but I was led to believe that The Insides weren't that good. And then it's that expectation thing, sure. Right? You look at The Inside and you're like, actually, it's better than I thought it was going to be.
Now you're sounding like Phil, like you buy a book even though you don't like it. Yeah, well, I heard the inside art was bad, so I just bought 100 copies, you know, just in case.
Well,
no, I think I actually saw
to talk about what I'm going to talk about then.
I think I saw a few pages, actually, and I didn't think it looked bad, but then I had heard that it wasn't so great inside, and I was just like, I don't know, I don't think I necessarily agree with that. Like, you know the boom books, like the Power Rangers, the Once in Future King, and then, like, you know, I wouldn't say there's a boom style, but there's a certain coloring and look to a lot of their books. Or the Seven Secrets I covered, like, it's, I find it's all within sort of that realm, where it's not totally pedestrian, but it's also not super dynamic.
But there's a lot to the coloring.
Yeah.
Right? As to how it's presented. I think in this first issue, I was just flipping through it as you were talking about it. And I hadn't read it, but the art serves the story a lot better once things start getting surreal. Once the costume hits, once things start flying around and things start getting crazy, it works a lot better than like the regular head talking, you know, people hanging out in the real world kind of scenes. I think those aren't necessarily serviced as well, but
yeah,
I think they're fair. Doable.
Yeah. I think it's a fairly traditional secret origin story, but I don't know. See, when I was also reading this, I'm like, this is kind of like an Invincible number one or maybe Dark Hawk number one, although it's been a long time since I've read Dark Hawk number one, but I remember him finding the amulet and all that
right
type it's of thing. All... So I don't know. And the thing is, sometimes I can't tell. Like something like an Invincible number one, everyone's like, oh, this is the greatest thing ever. And then by the time it got up to issue 4 or whatever and the trade came out, I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to check this out. And then I read that and I'm like, yeah, this is kind of traditional, and like, but that right. That became something, but I don't know what really makes that a whole lot different than this.
It's in that, it's that old In the Spirit of Spider-Man kind of thing, trying to make that, it's that, like you said, that Dark Hawk or, you know, but
yeah,
this is more Invincible-y for sure.
Like I don't want to be... And then don't be one of those guys, you know, but yeah, there could have been more something unique in here to really grab your attention.
Him vomiting out of a mouthless mask isn't eye-catching?
I mean, that's interesting discovery. And
how are you doing like, that without a mouth?
Hour his friend comic is yelling. Where, like, you have an idea. And the whole first thing is like, oh, you set up some characters and then you have them goof around with like their new weird black hole sun suit. And then you're done. Like, I mean, there is a cliffhanger.
Yeah, there is.
But it's not anything weirdly like... out of the ordinary or something. I mean, I don't know if you would have been better served by doing a double size first issue. Like, I don't know if that would have been that much better. I mean, I guess you could have cut down on some of the splashiness or the Marvel 2-page spread of just the title, and like put in a supervillain fight or some armed robbers robbing some cool high-tech facility or something. I don't know. I mean, I need to read another issue, but if someone was like, there wasn't anything super exciting and that's all they're going to read, like, that's fine.
A fair criticism.
I'll see what happens, though. I mean, it was entertaining enough, but I don't know if I'll ultimately stick with it down the road. We'll see where it goes.
So only first issue out so far?
Only the first issue.
All right. Phil, you got anything you want to lay on us?
Sure. I recently acquired, I almost have all of them from the company Arcade Comics, all those Liefeld comics he did. And basically this company was around for like 3 years. This is his fourth company.
Three.
Oh, yeah. And
so they got like three issues out is what you're telling me.
Wow.
I have seven issues. And there's two I'm missing. One of them's a white whale of mine that I really want. And there's a bootleg copy out that was sold at a con, but it's like impossible to get. And then I don't have the collected hardcover, which is the first five Youngbloods, but redone dialogue and everything. But I don't really need that one. But yeah, so in those years, basically the company was meant, basically they released these issues at Comic Cons. And then their idea was get the buzz out. And then we'll put it in previews, but I don't think any of them ever made it to previews, if I'm correct. And, but yeah, it's so seven comics basically in all this time. So there's Youngblood Genesis, which was in 93, I think, or 94, I'd say, in the Extreme Comics, there was a double page ad, beautiful art, and it's a Kurt Busiek Youngblood year one story. That was supposed to come out, but it never came out. So then all this time later, that's what Youngblood Genesis is. But he's not involved anymore. They just took his plot and then did the dialogue and everything themselves. And it's basically their first year of Youngblood. And only two issues of that came out. But I actually kind of enjoyed those. Then there was a Youngblood title called Bloodsport by Mark Miller. And only one issue of that came out, and it's basically like Battle Royale where all the Youngblood and superhero people have to fight it out to get on a team. And the second issue is the bootleg I was talking about.
So are these designed to be one, or they just end with a cliffhanger?
No, they're meant to keep going. Like every young Rob Liefeld comic, you know, he gets one issue out, and then nothing ever comes out. Like, it's crazy. And then there's another Youngblood one, Imperial, which is by Robert Kirkman. Surprisingly, it's kind of like Justice League International, where there's a bunch of different Youngblood teams all over the world. So only one issue of that came out. And it in the back, there's like a page, you know, saying, oh, we can't wait to get all these other issues out. And then there was an issue one of Nitrogen, which was... oh, this one was like these heroes you just... well, not even heroes, but these kids that you hated. And it's them going after all the old superheroes kind of thing. And a year later, there was finally a second issue of that, I think. It's called Nitrogen Extreme Forces Number One. So it's another number one. Doesn't continue it or anything. And it's just like another story. And then the hard one I had trouble getting. It's really hard to get this one. It's Supremic Sacrifice Number One, which was going to be this big Supreme story, but just one issue of that. And like all of them, like you don't even know what's going on because there's literally like no story in all of them where like you don't get enough, you know, because it's only ever one issue. And it's amazing he's still around doing comics because his awesome line was it's all like a lot of them. There's just one issue, you know, of Profit or one issue of Brigade. His extreme ones are the only ones where the comics kept going for a bit, you know. Youngblood's never made it to an issue 12, even though they've been advertised. Mm-hmm. One volume skipped from issue 11 to 14. Like, they never even put out the other issues.
So out of these seven comics, like, which was the best one you read?
Well, for me, I like the Youngblood Year One story. because I actually liked the artwork, and I kind of liked getting insights to these characters, which we've never gotten before, and it tied into other stuff I've liked, storylines I've liked in the Extreme one. The Mark Miller Blood Sport one is basically like the Authority. But and it's fun seeing superheroes kill each other and stuff, but I don't think... But yeah, that's probably the only one I enjoyed.
And then, I like how that's not going to stop you from buying the rest of the
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I spent you can get all these for a few bucks. The only one that's harder to get is Suprema one, but I got that for 20. And then, you're not going to break the bank getting these. And they're pretty, most of them seem pretty easy to get considering they were only at Comic-Cons. But I guess everyone just wanted to get rid of their issues.
They're not the real Liefeld fans like you are. Yeah.
So like you said, yes, I'm still buying shitty comics. I still have a problem that I'm working on it, because at least now I realize it, you know? So I can work on the issue.
12 steps.
Yeah.
I would say at least you're enjoying them, but it doesn't even sound like that bar is not being met.
I've got boxes and boxes of the shittiest comics you've ever seen.
Going to hell in a bucket, but at least I'm enjoying the ride.
Sort of.
After reading the Steve Skroke, Doc Frankenstein hardcover, I was pleased to see and wondered if it was not coincidental in previews that a new Steve Skroke written and drawn series with Dave Stewart colors was coming out from Image Comics, and the first three issues are out of Post Americana. This one is it's like a totally like a Mark Miller like epic. There's few characters, lots of world building, but it doesn't slow down to do the world building. It's really fast pace and fast moving. And this is like a post-apocalyptic world where there's a whole society of Americans that are living in this mountain fortress where they survived the Holocaust. And it was supposed to be where like the president and would be and all of the ruling class, but they didn't make it. And at the last minute before they had to close the doors, there was just a bunch of like wealthy corporate people who got in and took over basically and didn't do any real society rebuilding or anything, and slowly just, you know, became a awful society where they are now armoring up to what they're saying to kind of fool the populace that still has good people left of it. They're saying they're going out to help make the world, you know, like to tame the wasteland and to help the people that are out there and see what's out there and do what they can to restart the country. But really, they're just going out and like blowing up every settlement that they can find and just killing everybody left or right, whether they're good or bad or anything. So there's rebels from within this community in the mountain that are trying to sabotage it. And one escapes and gets hooked up with this girl who's really has been through and seen a lot, but she's like a real competent fighter and stuff. And they have to deal with these wasteland gangs in the first issue and society of like cannibals in the second issue where they're going to be eaten and stuff. It's very entertaining and action packed, and it reads kind of like a, it's like quirky, but also like over the top and nasty in a way. Like it's like a Garth Ennis book in a lot of ways. It's like a Mark Miller Garth Ennis esque book, if you can imagine that. And like one of the wasteland gangs has a leader who has a jet pack or jet boots or something like that, so that he can be like in the air above everybody else. And he has these like wrist forearm cannons that he can rain hell on people. So that's why he's in charge. And everyone's calling him FF. And it turns out his name is Flying Fuck. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he says to people is, remember, the flying fuck gives. That's his, like, send-off line of encouragement. He gives a flying fuck, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty silly. But it's over the top, and again, lushly illustrated, and even more so. This is a really tight book. It's really good.
I have another non-comic book to discuss. It's
Andrew.
It's the Thornclaw Manor Monster Family album, an art book by Steve Ellis. I picked up the hardcover Kickstarter. I guess limited to 200. It's signed and numbered on the inside bit. So I have 11 of 200. So I mean, I think he would release these. I bet you this is just the kick. It's a hardcover, but it's slightly smaller. His highest profile recent work is the Only Living Boy and Only Living Girl series. I think it's that collected size, Steve. You know, that slightly smaller than a comic book size.
Yep.
Thing. And
the Traveler format.
A little bigger than Digest.
Yeah. And I love, I like Steve Ellis's work. Big fan. And this is something, I backed the Kickstarter where he had these characters on cards as well. And he's building up a bit of a mythology about it. So at the beginning of it's mostly like one page illustration. And then the next is like their little brief bio. My big objection is I would have taken less text and had a shorter book on bigger pages. Because I would love to see this on a giant, as big a page as I can. But I like that there's a cohesive mythology behind it. I just don't, like, I'm just enjoying the artwork. The other thing I really love is the back has a process section, but way more detailed, like, past the point of my understanding how he... So he features a couple pieces and then does a few pages, you know, showing the different process and a little text piece. But, I mean, a lot of it ends up being very specific about... You know, I used this type of pigment and this type of page and this type of watercolor. But it's still just interesting to see the different versions of it and how it comes together. I can tell he has some teaching in him from the way it's laid out very clearly, but I'm not. I just like to... I use tone Strathmore paper as the ground, and the watercolor worked beautifully. And all that sort of interesting stuff that I don't understand.
It's like he stopped to think about what to say.
Yeah. But also just Prismacolor white and dark browns. And yeah, so like watercolor, acrylic ink, like all the different tools that went into these different sculpts. Because a lot of them are basically like a sepia tone, but other ones are more full color. Or sometimes it's the sepia with a little bit of one color maybe added in. Or a little bit of white. So it's really a range of different illustrating ideas. But it reads in the back, it was kind of inspired a little bit by sort of Cthulhu meets Downton Abbey in a way. So the monsters are mostly humanoid, but dressed in suits and ties. And in fact, somewhat Lovecraft itself has some of those, like when he goes to Innsmouth, some of the ridiculous creatures are dressed in fancy clothes, but they all have frog heads and monstrous appendages and everything. So I really enjoyed it. Like I said, I'll be curious if they have developed narratives out of it, but just as an art book, it's totally worth it. I like his artwork. I'll see if I can find some link to drop in the show notes, but because I know he's active on some social medias and posts samples, but if you're not familiar, the second you look at it, you'll probably be like, oh, yeah, I know his artwork now. I did some Big Two work back in the day.
You can't mention Steve Ellis and Only Living Boy without me taking the opportunity again to thank you for introducing me to Steve, who you go way back with. And he drew for my kids in all of my volumes of Only Living Boy, a different character in each one. And did a real nice job with him. And I'm sure gave it extra loving touch because, hey, I knew you. You were my ticket to coolness.
I wouldn't say that, but we did. He was part of the batch of people that we all went to Syracuse together. And there was a comic book club. I think I've mentioned before, Fred Van Lente, Ryan, a whole bunch of us and other people that went on to different artistic venues. It was funny that I was like one of the few non-artsy people in that club.
And when you say Ryan, you mean Ryan Dunleavy, and he's participating in a Hero Initiative drink and draw that's happening later tonight after this recording that I have Dan Brereton doing a drink and draw coaster for me during.
Nice.
Yeah.
I actually wrote a story that he illustrated. So way back when, my first artist, and now he's a big fancy professional artist. So I quit while I was on top because it's a pretty dreadful story, but he did a beautiful, beautiful job. Great. A great artist. I like all that crew. It was just weird how I ran into all these weirdly super talented people at this one moment. I mean, for all I know, maybe
we
every
need copies
year
of this comic, Andrew,
has Syracuse grads that are just kicking out comic book work. But it was weird that at that time, this small group all went on to, they went on to fame and fortune.
And you're with us.
And I'm with you guys. So who's the, I think we know who the winner is in that scenario.
Yep. Sure do.
All right. Does anyone have anything else they want to say?
I have another, continuing quest to, prove to people that I don't hate Stan Sakai.
No, he's so nice. I can't even picture him not smiling. Like, I've even seen him eat and I still think of him smiling. Like, so while he's chewing.
So I picked up this Usagi Yojimbo Wanderer's Road miniseries.
Okay. I read a bit of that. That's the new one?
Yeah, I think they're up to issue 4 now, maybe? Out of 7? I don't know how they pick 7, but whatever.
I'm sure they asked him how many issues it was going to get.
Well,
and he said, oh, to tell the story, I need 7. I don't think they were like, I was like, you have to fill 7 issues with this story. Pad it out or shrink it down.
There's a reason, Andrew, because it says featuring classic stories with brand new color. So it says this issue features one of his first adventures, The Tower. So I don't know, like, I know there was a series before this where they reprinted some stuff. So they must have decided, well, we're going to reprint 4 in this first series, and then we'll reprint 7 in this next one. So,
well, also makes sense with the new publisher, like, get the material out under there. Because this is IDW, I assume.
Yes, it is IDW.
Yeah, so your new publisher, why not? Yeah, hey, there's new readers all the normal time.
Yeah,
Marvel does it with Conan and Alien stuff. They're all reprinting it, right?
Yeah. And this is all colored up by Rhonda Patterson. So, yeah, this is... I remember, Andrew, you saying, oh, there's always some, like, folklore or fairy tale thing from... So then I was like, oh, well, I enjoyed, like, the Corpse Delivery Service and everything that had some weird Japanese idea or whatever, a single idea. But then I ran into it in like one of when they relaunched at IDW, and I'm like, oh, this isn't exactly what I was into. So then after then came my ongoing quest to not prove you wrong that every story was like that, but not in here.
Well, his first appearance was the Albedo number 2.
Yeah, if I ever ran into that.
My understanding is it's a pretty, like, not Action Comics number 1 valuable, but that it's a valuable book.
Yeah, it's one of those holy grails, I would say.
I'm currently rereading all the Space Usagis. Those are my favorite.
Yeah, we're supposed to get that show.
Oh, yeah?
That's supposed to be, like, some Space Usagi stuff.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I don't know what how far they've progressed on that. Maybe it'll be out. Maybe this, when this episode comes out in 2 years, it'll already be out, and Andrew will be like, "You dated the show."
I also like the one where he fights aliens. I forget what that story's called, but
not Alien.
No.
Usagi Yojimbo fights Alien, and then he can fight Predator.
No, I'm just remembering that Wildcat story Or it was supposed to be versus aliens, but what?
That's what I love that story. And that, because that's, I'm a big Stormwatch fan, and that's what made the Authority was that story.
But if you're not plugged in, mm-hmm. and then you think, oh, he wants me to draw Wildcats versus an alien, not knowing that aliens are property.
Like, that changed the universe big when that happened. That was crazy. I love that story. I reread that probably every year, I'd say.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is just a simple idea story where there's like some little lizardy, dinosaur-y dude that's animal? Dinosaur? I don't know.
Yeah, they have these weird little guys that run around, like, not anthropomorphized.
So this little guy is, like, hungry, and he's, like, going about all his different things to find some food, and then tries to steal some from a restaurant, and then some guy is just like, that's it, this is the last time, and starts running around with a butcher knife, which causes this little animal dude to go up a tower, thus, you know, calling the story of the tower. I'm not quite sure why there's a slightly unstable tower really high in the middle of the city. Like, I guess they're building something, and this is what you do first. And there's, like, a platform at the top. I mean, maybe not the best architecturally sound decision-making. I don't know. Maybe it's for something else. Maybe I don't know what it's for. Maybe people go up there and you can see if there's invaders coming into your city, right? Maybe that's the purpose. It's not construction. But anyhow, there's a large crowd that forms, and then they're all waiting for this animal dude to get swept off by the snow or the weather, the winds, and then this guy's gonna kill him and eat him? I'm not sure. So that's when Usagi comes upon the situation, and he's like, oh, this dude's hungry. I'm going to go help him out. And this seems like a whole bit. Like, this is a whole, like, Mr. Bean sketch or something, because the whole time Usagi goes up this ladder and he's at the top, he's just, like, irking the guy with the butcher knife, because he's just like, oh, like, anything he does, it's like, it just finds its way down the ladder and onto this guy's head, enraging this guy more and more. This guy is a funny bit. And that's pretty much the story. I mean, no harm comes to the animal dude.
So are you going to buy more of this, or you just come across as one issue?
Andrew, why? It was my quest to read more Stan Sakai, but also the covers for the series. Guess who the covers are by, Andrew?
Peach.
They're nice covers.
Nothing wrong with that. You like the Peach Momoke? I don't remember her last name, but yeah, she's one of the Marvel Stormbreakers. Hey man, yeah. I get it. You want to make money on this crazy habit we're in.
I don't know how many people are looking for Usagi covers, and it's not the incentive cover, but sometimes those covers don't always appeal to me anyways. Like, when she puts out like 100 covers a month, like putting J. Scott Campbell to shame. But, yeah.
She should do a collab with J. Scott Campbell. The two of them could own the cover market for like a month.
I mean, people joke about certain people like, oh, they do every book. No, seriously, I think she does do a cover for every book. Like, you could have a Marvel Comics month and, like, every cover, like, they would do.
That
like,
happens more than once in a while. Because I remember when, maybe about a decade ago, I feel like Francavilla was doing, like, tons of covers for people.
I don't think it was ever that amount, though.
Well, you're more dialed into the dollars and cents of this thing.
I mean, I remember when they had, like, variant cover events at, like, the Distinguished Competition where I was like, oh, Darwin Cook's going to do, like, every cover as a variant this month or something.
That is...
Which was cool.
Yeah, I do wonder how many are just people buying like variant hunters or just Darwin Cook fans. Every time there's something like that, I wonder if it's like, is it the variant cover people or the Darwin Cook people that are the majority? I mean, obviously there's both, but I wonder who's driving the bus. Like,
what's weird about that is like other artists are either upset that his style is so simple and that he's so good, but he seems to be more like, yeah, people like him. I think he's great, but artists like him, but it's not, I would say none of the variant cover crowd or those people would ever chase, and I've never seen them chase those books. Like, that's not who you get if you're trying to pop your covers. Like, you know what I mean? It's not, like, yeah, he's popular. Yeah, he was a name, but, I mean, it's not like you're... It's not like any of the modern cover artists that get to move the needle. So yeah. I don't know how that worked, like if that did well or not. Like, I don't know. Every time I see those covers, though, I usually pick them up because they're awesome.
I agree with that. It's always good to see fun people having fun with stuff. All right, does anyone have anything else before we wrap this thing up?
Nope. Should I bring up one more thing, Andrew?
What is it? Is it something I'm going to like?
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Artisan Edition.
Oh, sure. I like those. So is this the Eastman and Laird stuff? Or?
Yeah, it's actually just the first issue. But they have basically three versions of the first issue in like the oversized big, but not like super oversized. It's like, I guess maybe it's like the half. Isn't the Artisan like the half or something?
No, the difference is the Artisan means that they don't have the complete issue. It's more just they have chunks and they're out of order, and it's just like a collection of... Because some of the books they can't run, like they were sold to the 8 million different people and they can't find them anymore. So those are the Artisan editions, where the art editions are usually a bunch of mostly complete issues. I mean, they have one or two pages that are like, this is a reproduction. Get over yourself.
Well, I'm not gonna tell IDW, you can, that they're wrong. But this is the first issue.
Well, they might have also worked in that size. Like, I don't know what size Eastman and Laird worked in. Oh, it could be. Some people don't work in. I have some...
Is it a hardcover or a softcover?
Yeah, it's just like those editions. Like, it mimics that style where it's a hardcover, but it's more like, I would say, closer to the original art page size, like the smaller ones, like not the big ones. Like, it's sort of like 11 by 7. Does that sound right?
Yeah, because I have some of Ryan's work, and even in the same, some of them are the full size, and then he worked in a smaller size for some pages. So not everybody works on the regular comic book board that we all think of.
No, it would be 17 by 11? No, that sounds more right.
Let me grab my piece here.
But anyways, yeah, they have like three different versions of the first issue. So they have like the rough layouts, then like the inked version, and then the actual like thing that was published. And then they have like random stuff in the back where it's like early sketches, designs, and promos. So it's pretty cool if you're a Turtles fan.
Well, I love their collaborative style where they would each work on the same page, so it kind of blended them together.
Yeah. So like, worth a while.
That's kind of unique. Yeah, I just, like I said, I wanted to note that and when I saw the Cursed Pirate Girl, Jeremy, the artist, that guy, he works in a very small size, too. Like, he is not, with that super detailed work of his, yeah, it would take him years to do a page otherwise, because they had a gallery showing of that, and I was surprised how close to the page size it was, in a way.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by the page sizes. Like, maybe, like, when you get the comic, like, maybe you think that it's just slightly larger, like, why would they ever draw on a bigger size, right? Because then it seems like it would take twice as long.
Yeah, especially those golden age pages when you look at the twice up ones and you're like, wow, those are big pages. That's a lot of, but then they could, you know, if they had a lot of panels or they could really put a lot of stuff in there.
But that's crazy to think like, oh, you're drawing like all this extra stuff, but still you're putting out more than like artists nowadays. Like I can't fathom that is insane.
That is true.
But yeah, of course it would take you less time. And that's what certainly kept like something like Walking Dead or whatever on schedule. So.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's up to the artist's choice to decide what's... Well, I mean, if you're working digital, you're whatever size you want to work in, you know?
Yeah, that solves that issue for sure.
All right, gentlemen, I think that's a pretty good episode. Want to thank you guys. Do we have any parting thoughts, catchphrases, etc.? Kevin?
There is no catchphrase. Have I used that before?
Yes. You're using it, I think, every time, episode in 2021. Phil, you got anything you want to say to leave the people with?
Hell no.
All right. Well, I want to thank everyone for tuning in. Hopefully I can wrangle the crew together for another episode and stay safe and, you know, just get through this thing.
Later.
The jungle. Here I was born. And here my parents died when I was but an infant. I would have soon perished too had I not been found by a kindly she-ape named Kala, who adopted me as her own and taught me the ways of the wild. I learned quickly and grew stronger each day. And now I share the friendship and trust of all jungle animals. The jungle is filled with beauty. Danger and lost cities filled with good and evil. This is my domain, and I protect those who come here, for I am Tarzan, Lord of the Jungle.